All right, well, good morning, everybody. It's been a rich morning this so far, and I'm glad that I came. So it's good, very good to be with everybody. So last Sunday, we, I'm sorry to be so fussy. Could you turn that light, that little spotlight off? Because it's casting a shadow from this, and I can't, they're much better. Thank you. Okay. While we're on my OCD moments, there was another one this today. We replaced the bulb in that, but does it still look like it's dimming now and then? No? Yes?
Yes.
This is troublesome. Okay. We'll see what we can do about that. All right, let me start over. Last Sunday we surveyed the life of Jesus, drafting up a general timeline of his three-year ministry, giving special attention to the week of Passion. Hopefully you will remember this. That would be the final 7 days from his triumphal entry into Jerusalem to his arrest, trial, and crucifixion, and then his resurrection 3 days later on Sunday. We all know how this works and pretty familiar with it. Time limitations only allowed us to cover some of the events of that three-year period. However, a couple days ago during our Good Friday service, we were able to get into more details regarding the crucifixion of Jesus and the events leading up to it. And if you were here, you participated in that. And this morning, we're going to do the same with the account of the resurrection. And for this, we'll be following what's reported in Matthew's gospel. He provides a pretty straightforward record of it, one that's easy to follow, and I'll assume that most everyone here is pretty familiar with it. And hopefully you're able to grab a handout during the break, and if not, and you didn't get one but would like one, just raise your hand. Gary, the faithful servant, will fix you up. So just make sure you raise your hand. We still have plenty left. So the plan here, as you can anticipate, is to read a section at a time, and then I'll offer some comments on it. And I have recruited certain volunteers to help with those readings, and we'll be passing the mic around so that those who are watching online can hear. So we'll pick the story up toward the end of chapter 27 with the burial of Jesus. That's where we will begin, starting there in verse 57. So, Cheryl?
As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb.
Okay, Joseph, as we know from the other Gospels, was a prominent member of the Sanhedrin, and that he had opposed their decision to condemn Jesus. Up till then, he had been careful to keep his admiration of Jesus and belief in him secret out of fear from the other religious leaders, from his peers. But during that trial, with his vote to acquit Jesus, his support for him was now out in the open, and he was, as we would say, on the record as being a disciple of Christ, and Matthew takes note of that in verse 57. Matthew also points out in that same verse that Joseph is rich, and this is seen by the fact that he owns a new tomb, which he provides for the burial of Jesus. This reminds us of the prophecy in Isaiah 53, where it is foretold that the Messiah would be numbered with the transgressors regarding the way he died, but yet in his state of death, he would be with the rich. It was actually unheard of to provide a proper burial for anyone who was condemned and then executed as a criminal. Their bodies were either left on the cross to be eaten by birds or thrown on the ground to be consumed by dogs. However, based on a commandment in Deuteronomy 21, Jews objected to any of their own being left unburied, and so Rome would often allow Jews to bury a condemned criminal. However, in those situations, such bodies would be disposed of in a common burial plot with other criminals, not in a family tomb. And therefore, in that regard, it was still far less than a proper burial. And so all that we read about here, that the body of Jesus was being taken care of, carefully wrapped with clean linens, and placed in a brand new tomb, you know, we have kind of the sort of no expense spared kind of arrangement. All of that would be quite unheard of, would be quite remarkable. Now, the first step in all of this, of course, is to get permission from the Romans to treat the body of a condemned criminal with any kind of honor or respect was to honor the criminal himself, and you just cannot do that. You know, Rome has condemned the criminal, has counted him his life as being unworthy, and you dare not say or do anything that could indicate anything less. So you have to be very careful with this. And Joseph, we are told, went right to the top and approached Pilate. And that he was even able to speak to the governor gives us some indication of the respect and prominence that Joseph had. In fact, we could assume that this may be one of the reasons that Pilate granted his request. Joseph's reputation warranted a favorable hearing. Matthew speaks of evening approaching, referring to sunset, which would mark the end of Friday and the beginning of the Sabbath. That being the case, everything had to be hurried along, removing the body from the cross, washing it, wrapping it with linens, carrying it to the tomb, getting the tomb ready and laying Jesus in it, closing it up, and so on. And because once the Sabbath started, no work, of course, among the Jews would be permitted. And in this, Joseph could not have acted alone. Removing the body from the cross itself would require the help of others. John's gospel tells us that Nicodemus, another Pharisee and follower of Jesus, was there to help. He brought 75 pounds of spices, which they used for wrapping the body. And all of this, along with carrying it to the tomb all before sunset, would have been an ambitious task for several people and very demanding for just two. Now, there may have been more involved than just Nicodemus and Joseph, but they are the only ones that are mentioned in the Gospels. Joseph had originally purchased and prepared this tomb, of course, for his own use. The thought probably never occurred to him that he would never be buried in it himself, but moved by recent events, he gives it up so that it could be used for Jesus. There were various kinds of tombs in those days. Many were sealed with some sort of boulder wedged into place to discourage wild animals and grave robbers. Expensive tombs, like the one used for Jesus, consisted of two parts. The first was an initial entryway hewn out of the face of the rock, relatively small. This then led into the second part, the burial chamber itself, as seen here. The burial chamber was sealed with a cut disc-shaped stone that rolled in a slot cut into the rock. Matthew points out the one used as the tomb was quite large. The slot was on an incline, making it manageable to seal the grave, but yet difficult to open it. A number of men would be needed to roll the stone back up the incline. Here's another picture of what that might have looked like, and might have looked like in another one. I'm not sure if you caught this from the text, but Joseph is described as acting alone and rolling the stone into place, but more likely the language simply describes what he caused to be done. For instance, Matthew also says that Joseph carved out the tomb from the rock, but that too is highly unlikely. And as a rich man, this is something he would have caused, something he would have paid others to do. The point is, even if the stone were on an incline, help would still be needed to secure it in place. Under Roman law, no mourning was permitted for those who had been executed as condemned criminals. The reasoning is the same as what was mentioned earlier. The earth is a better place without them, and to mourn their loss is to contradict Rome's judgment on the matter. One dare not say or do anything that could be interpreted as protesting Rome's pronouncement of guilt. It is, however, doubtful that this was some sort of established statute that was ever enforced. Nonetheless, we could anticipate that Joseph and Nicodemus would have performed all of these tasks with intense yet silent grief, restraining themselves emotionally. A couple more points on the fact that Jesus was buried in a tomb that had never been used would be in order here. It was common practice for several bodies to be placed together in a family tomb, but this was a new tomb, and so he was the only one who occupied it. And as long as his body was in there, he would be the only one who ever would. So let's just assume for the moment that he would not rise from the dead 3 days later, or for that matter, never rise from the dead. No one would ever be buried with him. No family member, not even Joseph, who owned it. And this because Jews would not allow others to be buried with a condemned criminal. It's all part of the proper burial protocol. To be buried with a condemned person is to share in their condemnation, and this contamination has to be avoided. We might assume that the tomb would be freed up for use if at some point someone were to remove his body, but that is highly unlikely given the Jewish laws forbidding such a thing. Of course, it's a different matter if Jesus himself somehow leaves the tomb on his own accord. We know from the book of Acts and other letters of the New Testament that an essential part of the gospel proclamation is the claim that Jesus was actually buried. Without being actually dead and actually buried, there could be no actual resurrection. And this is why a number of years later, belief in this burial was included in the Apostles' Creed and has been confessed with bold conviction in every generation in the church, because its significance here is very weighty. It just cannot be overstated. And finally, in verse 61, Matthew tells us that Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there sitting across from the tomb watching everything that is taking place. This other Mary, we do not know who that is. There are many speculations about that, but Matthew doesn't name her. And we are not told how long they stayed. Most likely it was until the soldiers came to guard the tomb. But as we read on, we see that they return to the site once the Sabbath is over, early on Sunday morning. And for their role as witnesses, they provide a level of continuity through the story of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. They were most likely the last to leave the tomb, and then later the first to see Jesus alive from the dead. All right, now for verses 62 to the end of the chapter. Noble?
The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard.
Okay, thank you. All right, so the sealing of the tomb and the placing of an armed guard adds to the dramatic triumph of Jesus' resurrection. It also provides the backstory for what takes place later in the next chapter when we learn of a conspiracy to cover up the resurrection with lies about the body being stolen. The Jewish leaders obviously do not believe in Jesus' predictions of rising again. They are merely afraid of a perpetual fraud. Jesus' first deception, if you will, was his claim to messiahship, of claiming to be the very Son of God himself. His last deception was this claim that he would rise from the dead. This is what they're all troubled about. Knowing that Joseph and Nicodemus were sympathetic to Jesus and his movement, they may have pictured the possibility that they would return the body to the disciples or in some way make it possible for them to take it from the tomb in the dark of night. Even if this were the case, we must appreciate that the disciples would have had a difficult time claiming a resurrection when all they would have would be just an empty tomb. It would take much more than that to sell the story. But the Jews did not want to give them even that opportunity. And so they approached Pilate and asked that a guard be posted. Now, at this point, we can imagine that the governor is growing even more weary of them. You remember all that transpired up to the point of Christ's death and all that he had to contend with the Jewish leaders. The phrase, "take a guard," in the NIV can also be translated, "you have guards," which is how a number of modern versions render it. If so, then Pilate would be telling them that they can use their own temple police and that he would not be providing any Roman soldiers. And this explains why after the resurrection, those who guarded the tomb reported directly to the chief priest, and not to Pilate. So whatever the case here is, Pilate by this time is more than convinced that the Jewish authorities are, well, crazy wackadoodles. I mean, he's just really getting tired of it. And he's growing more and more impatient with them. You know, we can imagine thinking something along these lines. You know, you were afraid of this man when he was alive. Now he is dead, and you are still afraid. If you really think it will help, go ahead, but use your own guards. I'm done dealing with all of this. Leave me alone. I think that would be his attitude. So with a free hand in this matter, the Jewish leaders would not be able to complain if things went wrong. They secured the tomb by posting their guards, sealing the stone with a cord and an official wax seal. And this, of course, is all quite significant. There had to be a way to show that the stone had not been moved or tampered with. If the cord and seal were intact, then this itself would dispel any talk of a resurrection. And so from their point of view, they had neatly prevented any possible attempt the disciples might make to start such troublesome rumors. You know, easy enough to refute. Look, the stone is still there. Look, the seal's in place. Enough already. This whole thing is over. You guys just need to be quiet about this now. But in doing this, they took on more than they realized. There's some irony here. They inadvertently ensured that they could not, later on, fall back on the body was stolen argument once the tomb was discovered to be empty. The very measures they took would actually support and reinforce the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. The irony here cannot be overlooked. In fact, on some level, it's actually comical. They take all of these precautions to ensure that the body would not be stolen, measures that are actually ironclad, and yet that is exactly what 3 days later they themselves end up claiming, which leaves only two options, both quite embarrassing for them. One, they were incompetent buffoons who didn't go far enough to secure the tomb, but really, what more could they have done? Or Jesus really did rise from the grave. On the other side of this are the disciples themselves. We need to think about this. And again, ironically, this whole idea of stealing the body of Jesus is nowhere on their radar, the farthest thing from their minds. We know from a number of other passages that they remain clueless about Christ's predictions. They probably thought that when he spoke of rising from the dead, that he was just speaking symbolically again. And this is why they are so surprised once it happens. You know, nobody says, "See, I told you." I mean, they're all clueless about it. On top of that, they are, of course, all cowering away in fear, hiding out in the upper room, fearful that they were next to be arrested. There is definitely no eagerness, no confidence, much less a plan to carry on the movement. They were, up to this point, convinced that Jesus was the Messiah. But now that whole belief they had given their lives to has been shattered. At this point, they probably don't trust their judgment about anything. The whole idea of overcoming the guards, breaking into the tomb, finding a secure place to permanently hide the body, and then go on and boldly claim, based on just an empty tomb, that Jesus has risen and is the Messiah and Lord of all, and then be willing to suffer and die for what they knew to be a lie, is just... You just can't believe it. It's utter craziness, foolishness. And all of that, to what end? For what purpose? So as we now head into chapter 28, we take note that in this account that no one disputes that the grave is empty. That itself doesn't prove a resurrection, does not actually prove it. But again, you cannot have a resurrection without an empty tomb. How it became empty and what that emptiness means is, of course, another question. One that Matthew now turns his attention to. Patty?
After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who is crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, 'He is risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you.'"
Thank you. Okay, so before we dig through this verse by verse, the first thing we should be struck with is how this account here that Patty just read enjoys a ring of truth about it. So what do we mean by that? Matthew's account, as do the ones in the other Gospels, each have a self-authenticating character. As one scholar puts it, the reader cannot help being impressed this is quoting the scholar, the reader cannot help being impressed by the extraordinary sobriety of the four gospel writers as they relate what, from any perspective, must, if true, have been the most stupendous event ever to occur in human history. Okay, so in other words, contrary to what we would expect, Matthew's account, for instance, is actually quite basic, quite simple. There are not that many details given. It comes across like a short summary. If this story were fabricated, we would expect all sorts of fantastical descriptions about all sorts of things. There is no description in Matthew's account of the resurrection itself, or of Jesus leaving the tomb, of how that took place, or even when. If Matthew made up the story, we would have expected him to elaborate on it, actually quite a bit. But there is no theological comment on what all of this means, and nothing about what might be going on in the unseen world. The story itself, though profound indeed, is pretty much matter of fact. There are some dramatic details indeed, but they all fit in line with what we would regard as a faithful and true report. In other words, Matthew simply lets the facts speak for themselves, and he provides just the facts that are necessary to explain what took place. And so if the story is an invention, quite frankly, it's a pretty bland one. Now, surprisingly, we find jazzed up versions of the resurrection in a number of those counterfeit gospels that were floating around during the second and third centuries. We find in them descriptions like the cross of Jesus following him out of the grave, multiple angels descending from the heavens, a loud voice ringing out from heaven, a darkness over all the earth, then instantly a bright flash of light from horizon to horizon. We have an account of death and Jesus engaged in a dialogue. Jesus laughing at death and then rising in the chariot of the cherubim, and so on. Cherubim. In contrast, Matthew's account doesn't come across as embellished, and the same can be said for the accounts in Mark, Luke, and John. And this testifies to the veracity of what is recorded. Even the way the disciples seem confused and bewildered when they first learn of the news, as reported in the other Gospels, is not what we would expect if these accounts were made up. Nor would we expect women to be the first witnesses, given that the testimony of women in that particular culture was considered worthless. So again, the Gospel writers were faithful to give it as it was and to let the facts speak for themselves, even if the facts were less than complimentary. And now comments on the text itself, starting with verse 1. Matthew states that the reason the two Marys went to the tomb was to check it out, to look at it, to use his words. Mark fills that in for us, telling us that they wanted to anoint the body of Jesus. But, of course, they were wondering among themselves who would roll the stone away from the entrance because it was too heavy for them to do that. And on top of this, we would have to wonder whether the guards would even let them enter the tomb anyway, which seems highly unlikely, but these particular obstacles did not keep them away. It appears that whether they would be able to anoint him or not, they had a strong emotional desire to be there, to be near him, and just could not be kept away. And now in verses 2 through 4, Matthew begins the actual account of what takes place. And as we read there, we see that there is a violent earthquake, an angel coming down from heaven. The angel is described as one who is bright as lightning. The angel rolls back the stone. He then sits on it. The guards witness all this. They tremble with fear and then faint in terror. So the facts, as stated, they're pretty astounding. But yet, technically, this is not an account of the resurrection. For nothing here actually describes that. No one witnessed the transformation that took place inside the tomb itself. Or, for that matter, no one witnessed Jesus coming out of the tomb. Not the soldiers, not the women, no one. But what is described is enough to tell us that something remarkable has indeed happened, and it all leads to one obvious conclusion. Now, the timing here is somewhat interesting. There is no mention of Jesus leaving the tomb when the angel rolled away the stone, and so we are led to believe that at this point he has already risen. And this has raised all sorts of questions regarding the nature of Christ's resurrected body. Was he able to pass through solid objects? We're also mindful that later on Jesus appeared to the disciples in the upper room and that the door was locked. Perhaps he could just appear and disappear wherever and whenever he wanted to. Some have speculated that Christ's resurrected body isn't even physical, that it consists of some sort of celestial, ethereal, spiritual something like a heavenly ghost. But this hardly squares with the facts. After his resurrection, he touches people and people touch him. He engages in conversations. He walks. He cooks fish. He eats the fish he cooks. He bears the scars of his wounds. He is clearly physical. Now, Paul touches on some of this, the nature of our future resurrected bodies, in his letter to the Corinthians. But the fact is, the Bible just does not provide a lot of information on this, and so we are left to speculation. And though it is all an interesting discussion, it's probably best to not get too sidetracked into those sorts of things. We know what we need to know, and we'll know more when we need to know it. What matters to Matthew, and this is the important thing, what matters to Matthew, as we see, is not when or how Jesus left, but the simple fact that now, early on Sunday morning, verse 6, he is not here. And so the stone was rolled back, the seal broken, the soldiers rendered helpless for the purpose of letting others in to see for themselves that he was not there. And on that note, the guards, you know, they're filled with terror, not because they saw Jesus, but because they saw the angel. The women are afraid as well. That's the words of comfort from the angel. Do not be afraid. The angel goes on to tell them that Jesus is risen and invites them to enter the tomb to see for themselves. And then he gives them specific instructions. Go tell the disciples that Jesus rose from the grave. Tell them to go to Galilee where they will see him. And certainly this is not what the women were expecting that morning. Everything has transpired here. In chapters 1 and 2, the only other place in Matthew where an angel plays a role in the narrative, the angel is seen or heard in dreams. Here, however, the angel is presented as robustly physical, rolling a huge stone, sitting on it, visible not just to the women, but also to the guards. The earthquake itself seems to be more tied to the angel coming down from heaven than to the resurrection of Jesus. Concerning the guards, well, they were probably questioning whether the Jewish authorities would believe them. After all, the whole thing about an angel from heaven rolling away the stone seems pretty far-fetched. And just kind of note the irony here, that those assigned to guard a dead man become like dead men themselves, while the supposedly dead man is actually now reported to be alive. Just a lot of irony going on, that whole thing there. All right, so next, verses 8 through 10. And Richard?
So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell the disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me."
Okay, thank you. All right, so filled with both fear and joy, the women run to tell the news to the disciples when suddenly Jesus meets them. The women clasp his feet to worship him like the angel did. Jesus calms their fears, do not be afraid, and then gives them the same commission. Tell my brothers to go to Galilee, basically repeating what the angel had told them. So the women clasping his feet is one of several examples that shows us clearly, quite clearly, that Jesus is not a ghost. He is flesh and bone. The words, my brothers, in verse 10, warrants a little attention, would be a detail we would probably tend to skip over, but we might want to think about it for a moment. Jesus could be referring to the 11 remaining disciples, or he could have a larger group of followers in mind, most of whom who had followed him from Galilee to Jerusalem, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. The women obeyed the angel, and all excited, overcome with joy, they run and tell the disciples. So before we move on, we must note that Matthew, of course, does not tell his readers all he knows. Let's just talk about this here for a second. We've discussed this in the past. As we're working through the story here, you probably noticed that some things seem to be missing that are not found in the other Gospels. Each of the four authors had their own purpose and were free to include details and leave out details as they saw fit. For instance, Matthew speaks of an angel at the tomb. Luke refers to two angels. That would only be a problem if Matthew said that there was only one angel, but he doesn't say that. Likewise, Luke and John have Jesus meeting with the disciples in the upper room in Jerusalem shortly after his resurrection, And there are other times that Jesus appears that Matthew does not mention. It doesn't mean that Matthew is claiming something different. It just means that for whatever reason, he isn't interested in reporting those other appearances of Jesus. And it may have something to do with one of the major themes he is developing in his gospel, that of showing that the good news of the kingdom is both for the Jews and the Gentiles. And therefore, Galilee, the region of the Gentiles, plays a prominent role in Matthew and in Christ's mission, all of which sets things up for the Great Commission, that of taking the gospel to all the nations, which is how the story ends. And so this may explain why Matthew focuses on Galilee as the place where Jesus appears to his followers. We can't say for sure, but it seems to be a plausible explanation. And now Maddie will read verses 11 through 15.
While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble.' So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day."
Okay, thank you. So Matthew's purpose here is to explain the origin of the what we call the stolen corpse theory. If people know the full story, they'll see where the real fraud actually goes, where it actually is. And it comes down to whether the guards fell asleep or not. It all pivots on that. If so, then this provided an opportunity for the body of Jesus to be stolen. If not, then there has to be another explanation on why the tomb is empty. The guards only claim that they fell asleep after the chief priests offered them a large sum of money. The fact that it took a large sum of money suggests that there was no small degree of reluctance on their part. Now, even temple guards, guards of the Sanhedrin, are ultimately accountable to Pilate. And so if he ever hears any report of them sleeping, well, it could go very bad for them. However, part of the deal that's being arranged here includes the chief priests handling that problem on their behalf. The story the religious leaders devise shows just how desperate they are for an explanation. And it is not a good plan, but it is the only one they can come up with. And given the number of converts we see in the coming months, literally thousands, according to the book of Acts, It is a story that has failed to convince, would probably be the best way to say it. All right, and now the final verses, a familiar passage we all know as the Great Commission. And Ted?
Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age."
Okay, thank you. I only have a couple comments about this passage. Later this year, probably in the coming weeks at some point, I hope to do a sermon on the authority of the apostles, how they were commissioned by Jesus, and what that commission entails, and why any of that is even relevant to you and me. And so I'll wait until then to dig into this passage more. Perhaps the most puzzling part of this whole chapter that we've been through here is verse 17, where we read that some of them doubted. And so let's just talk about that for a moment. It raises several questions. Who is doubting? Why are they doubting? And did they continue to doubt once they left the mountain? And Matthew doesn't say, and so finding satisfying answers to these questions can be a little difficult. We can offer up some, you know, plausible theories about what is going on, but we can't really say anything conclusively here. If nothing else, those words help yet again to reinforce this ring of truth that I referred to earlier. If Matthew was inventing this story, he certainly wouldn't be reporting that some who had saw the risen Jesus were struggling with doubts. So the first question we need to answer is, who exactly is there on the mountain with Jesus? If it is just the 11, which seems to be implied in verse 16, then it doesn't make sense that they were doubting that it is Jesus they are seeing, or that Jesus has been resurrected. It's hard to draw up a precise timeline of all the events, but we can safely say that based on what we know from the other Gospels, that Jesus has at this point already appeared to the 11 and has done so more than once. They know he is risen, they have seen him, they have talked with him, and so on. And so any doubting going on among them must be related to something else. If, as alluded to earlier, we would read brothers in verse 10 as referring to a larger group of followers, perhaps some of the 500 that Paul refers to in 1 Corinthians 15 as having seen the resurrected Jesus, then it would be easy to see why some of them, having seen him for the first time perhaps, would have had doubts. Is that really him? Peter, John, and the others were telling the truth after all. I can't believe it. This is incredible. Maybe they were questioning their eyes. Whatever the case, we could assume that such doubts were eased as each one had a chance to interact with Jesus there on the mountain. On this, we might think of Thomas in the upper room, for instance. Other possibilities open up once we take a closer look at the word translated as doubted. It has been pointed out that the verb used here refers more to the idea of hesitation or wavering than disbelief. And so it could be that they doubted on what they should think, do, or say. And the context supports this. Whether we are dealing with just the 11 or a larger group, Matthew tells us that some worshiped Jesus. However, others were a little hesitant, perhaps unsure about what to do. And it may be one of those, you know, you just had to be there to understand kind of situations. Or maybe they were wondering why they had been asked to come and what was going to be expected of them, maybe even doubting themselves. And the context would support that as well. Whatever the case, Jesus responds to that doubting or hesitation with the following words: "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations." This charge to go and build his kingdom based on his absolute and all-encompassing authority should entice them to shake off any wavering they might have and step up to the plate, honored that they had been chosen for the task. All right, and it may be easy here, kind of wrapping things up, to assume that it was at this time here on the mountain in Galilee that Jesus ascended into heaven. I think that's kind of a common thing that people sort of assume. However, Matthew, we should point out, mentions nothing about Christ's ascension here. The account of it is actually provided by Luke in both his gospel and also in his book of Acts. And there we learn that this ascension took place on the Mount of Olives in the vicinity of Bethany, which is a small village outside Jerusalem, which is in Judea, not Galilee. And it seems fitting then to conclude with Luke's account of that, which would be the last paragraph of his gospel. And he writes this: "When he had led them out to the vicinity of Bethany, he lifted up his hands and blessed them. And while he was blessing them, he left them and was taken up to heaven. And then they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they stayed continually at the table, at the temple, praising God." What words. So let's stand. I'm going to invite the musicians at this time. We're going to close with the fitting song, "See the Conqueror, Raised from the Dead, Ascended into Heaven, Exalted at the Right Hand of God, Jesus, our victorious Lord, rules and reigns over the affairs of the universe, preparing for the day he returns in power, in glory, to establish his kingdom forever. And we who are his will be with him together and will reign with him together for all eternity," right? May his name forever be praised.